7.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Kidnapping is nothing new to Colombians. Rebel groups have turned it into one of their mainstays for making money and political statements. They hold wealthy residents for ransom. They often capture and kill local politicians and journalists. But the rules are changing, and Americans are at the center. The United States has broadened its own role in Colombia with an annual budget of more than $2 billion. American agents have expanded their work beyond drug interdiction and military support. Dozens of U.S. special forces have recently gone to Colombia to train local soldiers in counterterrorism. The rebels have responded in kind. They are currently holding three American government employees whose airplane crashed last week, and earlier this month they released a pair of journalists who were on assignment for the Los Angeles Times. It was, in fact, the first time that foreign journalists have been detained by rebels since Colombia's civil war began almost 40 years ago. Ruth Morris was one of the journalists held, and she'll be our guest this hour. Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. America's ramped-up presence in Colombia is designed to support the elected government. Is this an appropriate use of America's military muscle? Does it mean that Americans have to accept an even higher level of risk as a result? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Ruth Morris. She has spent years in Colombia. She's currently freelancing for the LA Times. She has also written for Time Magazine, the Times of London, and the BBC. She was released from captivity 18 days ago, and she's joining us from the studios of NPR in Los Angeles. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, good morning.
You have spent time with family, I guess. It must be good to be home.
That's right. I have family in the Boston area, and it was great to see them.
Now, tell me about this, because as I understand it, at first you didn't even know you were being kidnapped. It's not even clear that you were being kidnapped when you first met with the rebels.
Well, initially when we were taken at a roadblock, an illegal rebel roadblock, and what they told us there was that their commander wanted to speak with us, that he had important things to tell us, that he might even offer us an interview or give us some sort of communique. I think in retrospect, that was more of a tactic to sort of calm our nerves. I think the intention all along was to kidnap us.
Now, you've spent a fair amount of time there. Was this a foolish move by you to go to the roadblock?
No, I don't believe it was. I'd been in that area in Arauca in eastern Colombia 4 times on previous reporting trips. I'd actually talked to the ELN in that area and talked to the FARC in that area. And as other international journalists in Colombia will tell you, until this incident, we felt we had sort of like a diplomatic immunity in Colombia. We'd been able to travel around the country, and the armed groups in Colombia had more or less let us sort of go on with our work.
So they said that you should go with them. You went with them. What happened next?
Then we spoke with an ELN commander. He told us at first, he said something like, if you were to be kidnapped or detained, who should we contact? And we told him, you know, you can't detain us. We're international journalists. That was what we were thinking. We thought maybe they would want to check out our ID and then they would let us go. Then he went off and another commander came along from the FARC, which is a larger rebel group operating in Colombia, and to my mind a more dangerous group, a more belligerent group. And that commander from the FARC told us that they were also, that they were going to detain us. And then we were not quite clear who was going to kidnap us for a while, which was quite a frightening moment. In the end, I think it was sort of first come, first serve. The ELN got to us first. It was an ELN decision to take us off the highway where we were traveling and bring us to their commander. And from then on, we were always with the ELN.
Now, a lot of the kidnappings are premeditated. They will choose a senator. They will choose a leading journalist in Colombia. This was more than accidental, really.
Well, I think the very initial decision to take us off the road at that roadblock was almost a chance occurrence. It was a lower-level militia member from the ELN, I think, wanting to sort of bring a bit of a trophy to his commander. once we were in the ELN's hands and once they saw all the media hype around our kidnapping, I think they understood they had to proceed very carefully. And then that's when they held on to us and were not only sort of trying to engineer a safe release for us, but also, I think, wondering how they could turn the incident to a political benefit for them. They'd never had that kind of press attention, at least for a long time, in Colombia.
Tell us who these people are, the National Liberation or the National Liberation Army. That's the ELN, right?
That's right. This is Colombia's smaller rebel group. They have about 4,500 members. They have sort of a Marxist ideology. They want to foment a Cuban-style revolution in Colombia. They say that they are not involved in drug trafficking. The FARC are and don't deny it. The ELN, I think, sees themselves as a more ideologically based guerrilla group, whereas the FARC are more military in their eyes.
So what were the two of them doing together? I thought that they controlled distinct parts of territory and actually quarreled as much amongst each other as with the government.
They do, but in Arauca, they have formed a sort of loose agreement where they work together. They even go into battle together. And this might even be sort of a response to the stepped-up military efforts in the area. There's also a stronger paramilitary presence in the area. Those are ultra-right paramilitaries, also a legal group guilty of horrendous human rights abuses. And I think with that pressure, that's probably something that has made it look more appealing to these two rebel groups to put their differences behind them and work together in the zone.
Were these experienced soldiers who picked you up then?
Yeah, the people that picked us up were militia members, and they had all served at least 3 years, sort of what you would call active duty on the ELN, living in the jungle, learning how to survive in the jungle, and going into combat. And then after their 3 years, they've actually stepped this up to 5 years now, they are allowed to go back into civilian life, but they're never very far from the ELN, and they can be called up to do all sorts of things. They might be participating actively as militiamen, but be dressed in civilian clothing most of the time.
And were they threatening to you?
They weren't threatening. They weren't ever pointing their guns at us in a threatening way. We actually had very good treatment in the context of a kidnapping scenario. And compared to a lot of kidnapping victims in Colombia, we were really blessed. I mean, we had three meals a day. Our captors wanted to speak with us and reassure us. They helped us carry our bags. In the context of a kidnapping scenario, you could say we had the red carpet treatment.
Because you were foreign journalists?
I think that was part of it. I think the ELN understood also that this was unprecedented to be taking foreign journalists off the road and kidnapping them. Yeah, I think that was part of it.
But you also know, because you just mentioned that, you know, kidnappings often result in the death of the people who are picked up. Were you frightened?
I was frightened. I actually have done a lot of work on kidnapping as a subject in reports, and I know that it's perhaps between 8 or 10% of kidnapping victims who die in captivity. And those deaths often come more because of health problems that were already there when the victim was picked up. And I felt very healthy, very fit. I felt I knew a lot about kidnapping, and I didn't feel I could die in in that scenario unless perhaps there was a botched rescue attempt or if there was just sort of some militia member or perhaps a FARC member that wanted to take us off the ELN and there was some sort of conflict there. But I thought if we just lay low and try and get along with our kidnappers, there might be a ransom demand, but I don't think they would want to kill us.
You had been looking for a story about the rebels, and you certainly got one. But tell me, in the 11 days that you were being held, what it was about the people who held you that surprised you the most?
Well, it was very interesting to be sort of on the inside of a rebel group that's not, I don't think, particularly well understood in Colombia. One thing that I really impressed me was our captors were very curious about the world. They wanted more information about the world, and it was clear that they had very little. And they asked us a lot of questions about current events, about history, about world leaders. Most of them didn't have a high school education. They were really impressed that Scott and I could read quickly, that we could write quickly, and I felt that there was a real hunger there for knowledge and for education. And certainly I'm not the first person to say this, but one of the problems fueling the war in Colombia is a lack of opportunity and a lack of employment and a lack of education. And that lack of education was really on display among our captors. And I would think to myself once in a while, you know, if there had been great schools and maybe a few good social workers in Arauca 20 years ago, we might not even be in this predicament today.
Questions about the world. What kind of questions?
They would ask us questions about American politics. One of our captors told us that he thought that Adolf Hitler was the worst president that the United States ever had. Questions about World War I and World War II. Questions about September 11th, certainly.
And there were as many women as men among the people who were holding you?
There were two women in the group that was holding us most of the time, the 15-year-old and the 35-year-old that you mentioned
right.
in your intro there. When we were released, we were first with a larger group of ELN members and fighters, and there were a few more women there. But there weren't as many women as you see in FARC camps. In the FARC, there are about 30%. Of the fighters are women. In the ELN, the ELN that we were with, it was probably closer to 10 or 20%.
Was there one thing that they wanted to say to you as a representative of an American newspaper, that one sort of message that they thought wasn't getting through or isn't getting through?
Well, they were really clear that they felt that international or multinational companies were taking their oil away. Arauca is an oil-rich, if lawless, region, and Occidental Petroleum is taking oil, has an oil field in Arauca. This is an LA-based company. They feel that the royalties from oil that's coming out of that area are not going back to the people, and to a large extent that's true. There's a lot of corruption in among the political elite in almost any regional area, any remote area of Colombia. There's a lot of white elephant projects. Arauca, for example, has a velodrome for bicycle racing. And of course, there's no bicycle races in Arauca. It's Arauca, I think, is the only city that in Colombia where that has an airstrip with two control towers. So there's a lot of
sounds like some of their complaints may actually be accurate.
That's true. On the other hand, the rebels in that area are indirectly benefiting from oil revenue. What they do is what they call it taxing or extort money from public officials or from contractors that are getting money to do public works. And so the rebels also are getting some of that oil revenue, and that oil revenue is not going to the people either.
All right. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Just last month, some 70 Special Forces soldiers with the U.S. Military went into the area that Ruth is describing. It's a $100 million contract under which they are training the Colombian military in counterinsurgency. And one of the rebel responses has been an increase in bombings, which we've been reading about in the news, as well as an increase in kidnapping. Does the United States have to bear a bigger burden as a result of its greater involvement in Colombia? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR News.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Ruth Morris is our guest this hour. She's a freelance journalist who reports from Colombia for the Los Angeles Times, as well as a number of other publications. She was picked up by the ELN rebels in Colombia on the 21st of January, was released at the beginning of this month, held for 11 days, and she's joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. And Ruth, were the rebels talking to you about the increase in U.S. involvement in Colombia? Are they up to speed on the fact that the special forces are now there, that there's extra money being given to the military?
They are aware that there are 70 Special Forces trainers in Arauca, and they had actually arrived just 2 or 3 days before Scott and I arrived in Arauca. But they didn't seem daunted. Their approach is that the United States has been involved in Colombia for a long time, and that it wasn't surprising that these 70 trainers should come to their backyard. I actually interviewed the commander of the ELN's Eastern War Front on the day of our release, and what he told me was, let them come, you know, let them come on foot and experience guerrilla warfare. He said, we have 38 years experience at this, and he seemed pretty confident that it wouldn't be a huge problem for him.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to start in Williamsville, New York, and John's calling in. Hi, John.
Hi, folks. I'm glad to see that you were released unharmed. However, I really do have a problem. The sanctimony of your statement, of your profession, the way you do, the way you view your profession, as opposed to some perhaps American industrialist who may well be in Colombia to earn money for his company. Ergo, people working in Colombia. Now, I would like to ask you, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Ruth is the name.
Yeah. Ruth, as I said, I am very thankful that you are here. I was curious as to when you were there, okay? By your own admission, these people were ignorant, okay? Ignorant of the world, ignorant of, say, why America might be possibly the greatest country in the world, and how we have, you know, maybe fed people. We aren't out to exploit people. I mean, I'm curious if you ever conveyed that to these people when they were holding you and ultimately released you. And let me just ask, if you could answer this question, why is it different for a journalist to be kidnapped from a industrialist? What is the difference?
Okay, John, we're going to take the questions one at a time. And Ruth, over to you.
Well, it's not different in terms of human suffering, obviously. The reason why we as journalists felt that we had some sort of immunity in Colombia was that we had been allowed to travel around the country, that there seemed to be an understanding by armed groups that it was beneficial for all sides in Colombia if people were in these areas where there's combat going on, where perhaps the suffering is greatest in terms of losses to the conflict in Colombia, and that it's important to be there reporting from the ground level to explain what's happening, to explain to the world, to explain to those same industrialists that you mentioned who might be coming to Colombia what the situation is. In that sense, I think we do serve an important function, but certainly anybody who's kidnapped doesn't deserve that, and it's painful all around for that victim and for their family.
I take also from the tone of John's call, Ruth, that the suggestion or the implication that journalists, we take a kind of a favorable or a romantic view of the rebels who are in Colombia. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
I certainly do not. I don't, especially the FARC, I don't give them the benefit of the doubt ever. As we've seen in some of the news stories that have come out of Colombia recently, the FARC seem indifferent to people's suffering. I mean, there was a bombing of a night social club in Bogota last week where 35 people were killed, over 150 people were injured. You have to remember that in a bombing scenario, the people who are injured are often maimed, their lives are changed. Those kinds of injuries are really, really horrible. And these were people who are civilians who shouldn't be wrapped up in the Colombian conflict.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston now. Joe's calling in. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm glad you're discussing this issue. I think it's a very important one. The one point I wanted to make is that from the reading that I've done about Colombia, I found from sources like Human Rights Watch and other humanitarian organizations that between 70 and even 80% of the human rights atrocities that have occurred in the long wars in Colombia are attributed not to the rebel groups we're hearing about, but to the right-wing paramilitaries as well as to the government. And I've also read there are longstanding and continuing ties between the right-wing paramilitaries, who often serve, of course, the landed elite of the country, as well as the government, political ties, military ties, personnel ties. And I just think that as well as it's important to talk about this particular issue of kidnapping as well as the, you know, the FARC bombing, it's important to put this in context, especially considering the United States has been for years, as you pointed out, funneling money to the side. Kind of neutral observers are saying commit the majority of human rights atrocities, including the killing of journalists of Colombian origin. So that's pretty much all my comment. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Joe. Just before you begin then, Ruth, a quick word on the paramilitaries that Joe's describing before you...
Yeah, I'll just explain a little bit about them. These are groups that have been around, they haven't been around as long as the rebels, but they grew up sort of as a response to the rebels and the threat of kidnapping. And they also are tied in with the drug industry, the cocaine industry in Colombia. They're ultra-right death squads, basically, and they've made their name by going around to remote villages in Colombia, identifying people as sympathizers to rebel groups and massacring them. The group, the umbrella group, is known as the AUC. They did call a truce several months ago. They haven't held to it 100%, but it has reduced some of the violence in Colombia, in the countryside. And yes, they are responsible, or at least until very recently, were responsible for the majority of the human rights crimes in Colombia. It's a little bit tricky when you start comparing the left-wing guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries in terms of human rights abuses, because you don't want to fall into the trap of sounding like you're saying that some human rights abuses are more acceptable than other ones. You need to condemn them across the board. Both sides are committing very atrocious human rights abuses in Colombia.
All right, 1-800-423-8255. Joe, thanks for that too. Buffalo, New York now, and Doe's calling in. Hi, Doe.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
The gentleman before me just asked a question that that basically pertains to what I'm going to ask. I was concerned about, Alvaro Uribe is, a conservative landowner.
Uribe is the new president of Colombia.
Right. And there is quite the recent peace attempts with the AUC, and my question is, the United States is giving aid, and basically the AUC is involved in drug trade as well, and so it seems hypocritical that Plan Colombia is aiding him. And I was wondering what you thought about the recent peace plans, the peace attempt that Uribe made with the AUC, and then why the United States, basically hasn't been reporting much on the AUC violence. It seems like there's a bias in only reporting FARC atrocities. And then my other question
Just hang on to that other question, or I'm going to get a little bit lost here, Doe.
Alvaro Uribe, he's contacted the conservative landowner that basically is a land problem in Colombia. And I was wondering, what our journalist Ruth here thought of the recent attempts to make peace with the AUC and
U.S. support of Uribe as well, Ruth.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical about these any prospect of a peace accord with the AUC. I believe that the truce and these tentative contacts with politicians on the part of the AUC has more to do with personal decisions at the very top of the organization. Carlos Castaño is the head of the AUC. One of his closest commanders is a man named Mancuso. And the United States recently sent down extradition orders for these two men. And my feeling is that they might want to disarm, sort of to be with their families. They're looking for a way out of the conflict where they might have some sort of immunity, where they could stay in Colombia and not face this extradition order to the United States. So it's very difficult to go from there to saying that the entire organization would be behind a peace accord or behind a disarming, some sort of accord that asked them to lay down their arms. There are still some 8,000 or 9,000 AUC fighters out there, many of whom don't have another way of making a living, and the AUC gives them a salary. So I think we're a long way off, unfortunately, from a peace accord there. I also would like to address your point about how it doesn't seem like there's a lot of news about AUC atrocities. And part of that is a very shrewd move on the AUC's part. They've moved away from these massacres, which did get more press attention, and turned their attention to selective killings. I believe these selective killings, one or two a day, perhaps in an area that they're trying to, quote unquote, clean up, I believe that kind of violence is receiving less press attention. It's harder to report. It's harder to confirm. In some areas, there won't even be death certificates for these people. And so I agree that we need to really stay on the AUC and be watching what they're doing.
Doe was also asking about the new president. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is your backyard, not mine, but he was in large part elected because of his promises that he was going to bring a new military strongman attitude towards the rebels, right?
That's right, and that's what Colombians want. There was a failed peace process in Colombia under the previous administration with the FARC. Colombians were so frustrated after that. They felt like they really gave the president a mandate to enter peace talks and try and hammer out a deal. And the most that ever came out of those peace talks was sort of to set an agenda that was never really discussed. So Colombians are very frustrated. They voted for Uribe out of frustration to a large degree, and they voted for him to take a stronger approach. The thinking there is that the FARC or any of the other armed actors in Colombia aren't going to come to the peace table and negotiate in good faith unless they feel pressure militarily. And so I think the fact that Uribe is wildly popular in Colombia indicates that there is real widespread frustration among the population.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And next to Dick, who's calling in from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Dick.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
I thought it was very interesting, the questions that your captors asked about the United States and, you know, showed by their questions how little that they knew about the United States and how little they understood our country. But I just wanted to say that as a person who's traveled a lot in those areas of the world, it goes both ways. We know absolutely nothing about those people. Where is the reporting on that? Where is it coming from on our side to show an accurate picture of the thought processes and how those people really live? We generally, when we talk about them, we compare them to us, our standards, our way of life. As you know, that's not the way it is. When are we going to hear about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, when Scott and I were with the ELN, we ourselves were learning a lot about how the ELN operate, and they were, like I've said, you know, asking us a lot of questions about the United States. It's hard sometimes to really get inside to the thinking and into the organization of a rebel group in Colombia. It can also be dangerous, I think, as our kidnapping demonstrated. But certainly the more information that's out there, the better that is for
us. See, I'm really talking about the general populace, the way of life there, the way of the mindset, the actual economic situations of the area are really not known to us. When we talk about those people, and I'm talking about generally people in South America, especially the area you were imprisoned in, we talk about them as if they're like a suburb of one of our cities. And what I'm talking about is our total lack of understanding of the culture.
Do you think, Dick, that it is that lack of understanding which you know, feeds into government policy, or do you think that the people who are making the decisions behind something like Plan Colombia are the folks who do get it?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with national understanding. I really do, government policy. I also think that the American public is more apt to buy into our government policy because of their lack of understanding of the culture. Does that make any sense? We misunderstand them to just as big an extent as they misunderstand us.
If I could just jump in there, and perhaps in self-defense, I have gone into remote areas of Colombia and done reports, for example, a profile of a coca farmer who produces cocaine. I've hung out with the kids that pick the or take the coca leaves off the plants and spend their lives roaming around the country working as sort of day laborers doing that. I do think that reporting is out there, and it's also some of the most rewarding reporting that you can do as a journalist, I guess, in any country. And I do agree with you also that it's extremely important to put this human face, a very clear, put forth a real clear understanding of who these people are. An important point there about the coca farmer that came out was that coca farmers in Colombia are very, very poor. They're not making any money. They're just barely sustaining themselves and their families by growing coca. And yet they are the targets of U.S. fumigation policy, U.S. spray policy, where the U.S. sends crop dusters and pilots down to Colombia to spray coca crops that kill the coca crops and leave these farmers without a means to survive. And they often have to move to another part of the country and maybe start up again. So that was an important point, and that came from taking a very close look at one person in Colombia who was working in that.
And do you think that in general policy needs to take that type of sense of the people more into account than it does?
Well, I would like to see that. I think that some of the U.S. Funding to Colombia does go to those sorts of programs that are more socially oriented. Until fairly recently, the U.S. was funding what they call voluntary eradication programs in Colombia aimed at weaning coca farmers off of the coca and into a less lucrative but legal crop. I don't really feel those programs were given a big chance to succeed, but some of them did, and some of that was funded by the United States.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. America has ramped up its presence in Colombia just in the past few weeks. It's designed to support the elected government of Uribe. Is this an appropriate use of American military muscle? We're talking with Ruth Morris, a longtime correspondent based in Colombia, who was recently released after being held as a captive by one of the rebel groups for 11 days. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is W.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Ruth Morris is my guest. 18 days ago, she was released after being held for a week and a half by the ELN, a rebel group in Colombia. And this hour, a chance to hear from her about the people who held her and a little bit about the country itself. We have a call now from North Carolina from a gentleman who has asked us that we not use his name on the radio, maybe, sir, you can just explain why.
Well, yes. My problem is that I have family in Colombia. I moved from Colombia after I was kidnapped from the FARC guerrilla. And I moved to the United States, and we applied for asylum. The government gave us an asylum, but I have all my family, my parents, my brothers, my sister, my nephews, still in Colombia.
Who was it who kidnapped you?
FARC.
And how long were you held?
I was lucky because it was less than one day because I escaped from them. So after that, they start to, and that's time to train my family, train my children. So we decide to move to the United States, and we just left all the properties, all the things that we have there.
Were you kidnapped because your family is wealthy or because of the work that you were doing?
Because I was in the wrong place in the wrong time. I was in the road where they were fighting with the army. So I didn't realize that they were there because it was very late at night. So I was in the middle of the fight, and they came in that time. Let me tell you something. I'm a professional, you know. Wealthy in Colombia, you know, the wealth in Colombia is because you have one house and one car. This is it. This is how wealthy people there. You know, they start to kidnap probably 15 years ago, and they start with the multinational directors and the big company executives. After that, they start to move down to in the pyramid of the social scale in Colombia. So right now, you can be kidnapped just for $1,000 or something like that. You know, that is just business.
And tell me what your view is about America's role there. America's now working with the government to try and crack down on the rebel groups. Are you right behind that move?
No, no. My feeling, my personal feeling, is that all the money the Americans are going to send to Colombia is a waste. It's a waste because we have a corruption there, corruption in the army, corruption in some part of the government, you know. Our president now, probably he's a good man, but we have a corruption for many years. So that money not always go to do whatever it is supposed to do, that money, you know. So the point of view, the many people that move from Colombia is, if you are not involved with the problem in Iraq right now, probably you need to move to Colombia and take care about that country. Because it's no way. Now, let me tell you something. Colombia, the minimum wage in Colombia is $140 monthly. You can buy in Colombia, you know, for a little bit more than $1,000 a kilogram of cocaine. You know how much is in New York or any of these places, kilograms of cocaine in the street? It's a lot of money. So this is something that the government need to take the decision if this is an economical decision or political decision. Because it's the issue in Colombia from with the drugs is an economical decision. Uh-huh. So the government is not going to do anything.
Ruth.
But it's a political decision. Well, the government needs to take the different decisions, you know, because no matter what you're going to do, you know, if you have a population, they make money, $140 monthly to support families, five, six-member families.
I want to see if we can get Ruth in here. Ruth, our guest from North Carolina is talking about is, you know, whether or not it's an economical or whether or not it's a political decision for the U.S. to be there.
Certainly, there's an economic interest in Arauca. There's the pipeline, which the rebels are attacking very frequently. They attacked that pipeline 170 times in 2001. That cost Oxy a lot of money. It also cost the Colombian government a lot of money in oil royalties that were lost, some $500 million in lost oil royalties. So there's definitely an economic component. I would like to just go back to a point that that our caller touched on. He was talking, I believe, about the markup also of cocaine in the United States. And this is something that I think is worth looking at. To buy a gram of cocaine in Bogota, where it's legal to consume cocaine in small doses, it costs, I think, about $5 to $10. And if I'm not mistaken, you go up into the, we're talking perhaps a 1,000% markup when you get to the streets of the in the United States. In any case, it's a huge markup. And as long as there is that huge gap between what cocaine is worth in Colombia and what it's worth in the streets, as long as it's in demand in the streets in the United States, there will be huge profits to be made from drug trafficking, and there will be money for the outlaws, the armed actors.
But what's your point, Ruth? Is it the markup or the consumption that you're addressing here?
I think it's the consumption. Certainly, Uribe has also touched on this point, and when he asks the United States for more money and more military aid, he refers to the fact that the United States is the number one consumer of cocaine, that cocaine is fueling the Colombian conflict, and that the U.S. has a shared interest in confronting the problem.
So back to North Carolina, what should the United States be doing?
Well, let me tell you something. Probably the next that I'm going to say, not many people is going to agree with this one. But if you know how the narcotraffic on people, you know, the dealers, they work, if the United States is going to make the liberalization of the consumption of the drug in this country, and like, I don't remember, Netherlands is the one country they have a free, but the government, they supply the doses for the people, you know. This is something that is real tough to say, you know. But let me tell you something. You going to New York, you say, well, after this date, you're going to buy a kilogram of cocaine for $1. What happened with all the chain, all the link of the narcotraffic people from New York to Colombia? Each one of these people owe money to another people. They're going to start to destroy themselves. Which one is the interest of the guy that is going every day to the school to try to get a new consumers and very young people, very young kids in this country? If he is not going to have profit, it's no reason, you know. But many people don't think about that, you know. If you cut the link, you know, the economic link of the chain, you destroy the chain. And these people, they are going to start to destroy themselves, you know. But this is a political decision, not economical decision. Now, I don't know if this lady is talking from Colombia. Probably 10 years ago was a big news in the newspaper in Colombia when one of the, I think, was the president of the stock market in New York.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to interrupt you there because I think that the point that you're making about legalization is an interesting one that I want to spend a bit of time with. So I'll thank you very much for calling into the program. It was nice to have you on. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Ruth, it seems like tough choices. I mean, when someone who knows the relations of the countries as well as our caller does says, you know, one of the few solutions is a legalization of cocaine in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are quite a few people I've talked to in Colombia who feel like legalization might be the way to go. But they also, I think, accept that that is not on the agenda in the United States. There has been a little bit of work on this topic in Europe and in England, and there are some advocates in England for legalization. But I think politically in the United States, it's much safer for a congressman to look like he or she wants to fight drugs than legalize right. drugs. And as long as that's true, I think we're far away from any realistic debate on the topic.
I want to bring you back to something else that he said, and that is that the money the United States is spending in Colombia is largely wasted. Because at one level, you're in support of the type of military crackdown that's underway, aren't you?
I guess I do see the point that a peace negotiation or peace talks in Colombia seem far off until there is sort of military pressure. But I also believe that there needs to be a social approach. As to the money being wasted, I guess my personal opinion would be that it would be nice to see more of that money go towards the, sort of closing the social gaps that are fueling the conflict, and not all of it or the large majority of it go to military operations. It is true that some of that money gets squandered. There was a scandal in the police in Colombia late last year, where about $2 million of U.S. funding to anti-narcotics police went into private accounts and into all sorts of bank accounts where it wasn't supposed to go. So that money does need to be followed carefully, and I think the United States is actually following it fairly carefully.
Are we looking at a time, Ruth, where the rules of the game are changing, both for foreign journalists and perhaps in a larger sense for Americans in Colombia?
Well, for foreign journalists, I think so. I think that in the International Press Corps in Colombia, we'll have to talk amongst ourselves about how we go about reporting in these areas that are remote and quite dangerous. And we don't have any assurances, particularly from the FARC or the AUC, that we can travel to the areas under their influence. On the other hand, you can't really get the story unless you're there. So that's a dilemma for us.
And what do you do next?
I'll be going back to Bogota on Sunday. I'll be resuming my reporting responsibilities. I'll be standing in for the LA Times. And I'm also working on a documentary on kidnapping. I had started that long before we were actually kidnapped, and I'll be finishing that off.
You have any second thoughts about heading out of town?
No, I'm happy to go back to Colombia. I did discuss this with my parents. I didn't want to go back if it was going to cause them a lot of angst and anxiety. But they were very supportive of my decision to go back. And Colombia is like my home. I've been there 5 years now. And I love the country, and I think the people are spectacular.
And what about the way your most recent experience will change your reporting? You've thought about that, no doubt.
Yeah, for the time being, I'll be working on projects that don't take me out to those very remote areas. I'll just have to take that on a case-by-case basis and see how things develop and see if the FARC, for example, make any statements about their attitude towards the international press.
Because though, I mean, there is a sort of formality to that, that the FARC or the ELN, the two rebel groups, could in fact put out a release saying, yes, we're going to be picking up foreign journalists?
Well, they, as you know, they've kidnapped three Americans who worked for the government recently after their plane went down with engine trouble in a FARC area. We'll be watching that. My opinion, personally, is that it might be nice to actually ask the FARC for them to clarify, ask all sides of the Colombian conflict, to clarify their approach to the international press and to try and gauge if they understand that what we're doing is to try and report the reality on the ground in the areas where they're operating, that we're not trying to take sides, and see what they have to say about that.
You're talking about asking some fairly civil questions in what seems like a really uncivil atmosphere.
I think it can't hurt.
Ruth, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ruth Morris is a freelance journalist who reports from Colombia for the Los Angeles Times. A special thanks this hour to Marcia Caldwell at NPR in Los Angeles for technical assistance. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is